Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Well, hello and welcome along to Unbelievable, the show with me, Justin Brierley, that helps you to think through your faith here on Premier Christian Radio as part of Faith Explored, bringing Christians and non-Christians together for conversations that matter every week. And it is Saturday the 13th of May, and that means, obviously, I'm not actually here at our studios in Premier. This programme pre-recorded because today, of course, is Unbelievable, the conference in London for 2017, and I've been looking forward so much to sharing the day with hundreds of Unbelievable listeners. I'll be bringing you a full report from what happened on next week's programme, and we'll hear some of the audio from the various sessions, and of course give you details of how you can get hold of the conference on DVD and MP3 CD as usual. But some other very exciting news from the past week is that the Unbelievable book has been published. The first pre-release copies have gone to Unbelievable, the conference. And on next week's programme, I'm going to be telling you how you can get hold of a copy wherever you are in the world, as well as playing out some of my talk from this year's Unbelievable conference about the book and why, after 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian. So watch this space for that at the same time next week. Getting into today's programme, I should just give a warning up front on today's programme that today's show is about pornography. Therefore, it deals with subjects of an adult nature. And some of the terminology in this edition of the show has been edited for the radio programme to make it suitable for broadcast this Saturday afternoon. The full unexpurgated edition of the show is available on the podcast and online, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, to find the podcast, to look at all the other resources, features, videos and more available there. Let's get into today's discussion. You're unbelievable. Well, welcome along to today's programme. Really pleased to have you with me for Unbelievable, the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and discussion. And today on the show, we're doing something we haven't talked about in quite a long time, pornography. Is it harmful to society? And again, just at the top of this discussion, want to make clear that today's show deals with subjects of a sexual nature, may not be appropriate for children. Do bear that in mind if you're listening with young people in earshot of your radio or podcast device. If you want to listen again at a later stage, the program's available at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Now, in the internet age, pornography is more accessible than ever before. The porn industry is worth billions of dollars, and it's estimated that, in fact, 1 in 8 internet searches in the world are for pornographic material. Matt Frad is the author of a new book, The Porn Myth, a number one bestseller on Amazon, and he critiques many modern myths about the supposed harmlessness of porn when it comes to consenting adults. He's a Christian, but he says you don't need to use religious arguments to show how dangerous pornography has become for our society. Science and social data show that it's having a detrimental effect on men and young people, as well as the people involved in the industry itself, families, relationships and more. If you want more info on that, I'll make sure you get the links from today's website. But here in studio to defend the use of pornography is Adam Scarborough from the Campaign Against Censorship. He says that porn use is a private affair. People should be free to do what they like in the privacy of their own home. And if adults find it enjoyable or helpful, they should be free to use it. And I'm also glad to say that, somewhat short notice, but great to have her on the line, being able to join us by phone is Charlotte Rose, who terms herself as the First Lady of Sex. She is a sexual freedom campaigner and involved in sex work, and indeed for arguing for the rights of people involved in the industry in various ways, and indeed campaigning herself against censorship. She knows Adam and has been involved in protests in that regard in recent years. So wonderful to have everyone on the programme today. Thank you for joining me for
today's show. Thank you.
Great to have you. Matt, perhaps we'll come to you before I introduce my other guests. First time being on the show, but I think you've been a long time Unbelievable listener, haven't you?
Yeah, long time listener. I've been listening for a few years now and always love listening, so thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you on, Matt. Many people may know you for your role in apologetics from a Catholic perspective, but this book that you've written, it's not really coming, as far as you're concerned, from a religious perspective, is it?
That's right. It's a non-religious response to pro-pornography arguments. I think that over the last, I'd say, 20 or 30 years, there's been a lot of research coming out of academia that gives us good reason to think that pornography consumption is detrimental to the consumer, to our relationships, and to society, and that there actually isn't really good reason to think that it's healthy for society. And so I travel and speak to about 50,000 to 70,000 people every year on this topic. I never imagined that I'd be doing this. I always joke my mum's really proud of me. But it's a real delight. It's been wonderful to be able to journey alongside men and women who might say they're addicted to this stuff and want to stop. So my approach is definitely not a shame-based one. It's basically trying to invite people to live the sort of life that they want to and not to let pornography stand in the way.
Well, it's great to have you on the programme today, Matt. Where did this particular interest in writing on this particular subject come from for you?
Yeah, so porn is something I dealt with as a kid, like many kids. I remember, you know, as an eight-year-old kid, this was before the time of the internet, if you wanted porn, you had to find a friend's dad, you know, who hid it in his closet. And I remember, you know, at the time, you'd say to your friend, you know, your dad's so cool. But as we got older, you know, looking back, I don't know if it really was that cool to sort of masturbate to women pretending to like you, that sort of thing. And so even though I looked at pornography a lot, I never felt terrifically, you know, proud of having done it. And it wasn't until about the age of 17 that I put in a good effort to try and stop it. I didn't like the negative effects I was seeing that it was having in my own life, in my ability to create, in my most cherished relationships. And so just started speaking out about it because I found a significant degree of freedom from it. And just started talking about it to other people. And obviously there's a lot of interest in it, so I've been doing that ever since.
It's a less taboo subject than it once was, partially because it is so widespread now, the use of pornography, its availability online and so on. I mean, do you have any information on how the statistics are in terms of usage among Christians as well? Because you might say, oh, Christians, you'd expect not to be using pornography. But I guess a lot of Christians, right, just as you did, struggled with using it.
Yeah, well, certainly, you know, studies show that religious people use pornography, or at least say they use pornography, far less than those who aren't religious. But certainly, you know, Christian men and women look at pornography. And so when people ask me if I speak at a, you know, Catholic university or something, why are you preaching to the choir? I like to tell them, well, the choir's looking at porn. So yes, this certainly is a problem among people of every different religion and none. And I want to make that clear because there's a lot of non-religious people who are speaking out against pornography as well. This isn't a religious issue. This is a, I just want a more beautiful life. I want a more fulfilling sex life or something issue. And so I know plenty of atheists and others who run significant websites.
And it's been interesting
talking out about it.
It's been interesting to see that some, you know, unlikely voices have come up recently on this front. People like Russell Brand and Pamela Anderson, you know, former obviously of Baywatch and Playboy pinup and so on. Not the most obvious voices, but people who've actually spoken out against the tide. I think Russell Brand compared it to a filthy icebergs floating through your house sort of thing. Why do you think that's happening in that regard?
Right, yeah. James Hetfield, actually, lead singer of Metallica, is also narrating an anti-porn documentary. I think it's because of the explosion of internet porn. I mean, since the advent of tube sites around 2006, a lot of people are beginning to speak out about the detrimental effects that it's having in their life. And I think perhaps the reluctance to speak out about it up until now has been just the fact that, like, no one is saying we want to go back to a puritarian era. where the sight of a woman's ankle could cause scandal. That's ridiculous, right? The problem with porn isn't that it shows too much. The problem with porn, I would say, is that it shows far too little of the human person, right? That it reduces a person to a sort of two-dimensional thing to be consumed. So the problem isn't sex. Sex is good. Sexual desire is good. If it wasn't, you couldn't make it ugly.
That's an interesting perspective. Thank you for joining us today, Matt. And somewhat unusually for the programme, we've actually got two voices who are going to be debating this with you today on the programme. Let me introduce the first of them, Adam Scarborough from the Campaign Against Censorship. Adam, thank you for joining me in
studio
today.
Yeah, you're more than welcome. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Could you briefly explain what the Campaign Against Censorship is?
Yeah, first of all, I'll just say to Matt, congratulations on his book. I did have a brief look at it. It's a very well-researched book, and it doesn't come across as ostensibly a religious publication. I was looking for little God quotes now and again, but I didn't actually see it. So you have stayed away from religion, to be fair to you, and there's a number of case studies in there. I've had a little look at it, but not too much. But yeah, what's our case? The CAC, the Campaign Against Censorship, basically stands for the right for consenting adults to see and view what they want to see, as opposed to what the state wants us to see. We never wanted, you know, a wonderful British writer, George Orwell, we never wanted to see 1984 arrive. Unfortunately, now with the advent of the Investigatory Powers Act and the Digital Economies Bill, it has, and what we're worried about is this creeping repression towards a totalitarian state. We believe individuals should be the right not to see something is just as important as the right to see something.
And what's your view of the rise of pornography as on the internet? I mean, do you kind of welcome that in terms of, you know, as in a neutral sense? You know, it's up to people whether they access it or not.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think? I mean, I know the internet has been a massive game changer in people's attitudes towards censorship, and with the, I think I understand 90% of the internet is pornography, I believe. Matt may know more about that than me. But I think sex is a very, very powerful drive, and it's I think there has to be provision made for sexuality. I mean, being a former soldier myself, I was stationed in various locations. The guys found ways of enjoying themselves and finding a means for their reproductive urges, shall we say. But I think to suppress sexuality is very wrong. But as far as children are concerned and the internet, I think, you know, there is a thing called parental control, and it should be down to parents, again, as opposed to the state, to decide what their children can and cannot see.
Let me come to our guest on the phone now, Charlotte. Charlotte, thank you for joining me. You're a colourful person, I will just remind all of our contributors on the programme today, we are broadcasting at a daytime hour. We're not post-watershed, so we'll just bear that in mind in terms of how graphic we are when it comes to discussing the subject matter today. But Charlotte, you've been involved alongside people like Adam in campaigning against censorship, and indeed you welcome adults expressing their sexuality through pornography or other means. You don't want to see anyone clamping down in this particular area.
You know, I've also been in a documentary with Russell Brand, and which was Love for Sale, which was with Rupert Everett in 2014. And I think the unfortunate thing is like Russell Brand, when you become an addict, as it were, is what he quoted himself as, they become the worst when it comes to reformed smokers or reformed addicts in that sense. It doesn't give you that opportunity to be able to see it in both sides. I think that what Matt is saying and what Adam is saying has got absolute massive relevance. But the understanding of what we've gone through in history is all about education. When we as a society has been taught to look at sex as a procreative attitude and nothing more, people will want to be able to explore sexual desire and exploration within their own bodies. And if there is no other material or educational a point of view out there other than pornography, where can people go to find that education? This is the unfortunate thing, is if we're not looking at sex as a desire, as a natural, normal form of sexual expression, then that education that we can relate to is not out there. The only thing that's being created is pornography, and that's the only choice that people have to go to be able to watch it.
So in that sense, are you saying, Charlotte, that it's not a good thing that there is so much porn, that is the thing that many young people, for instance, are likely to encounter more than, if you like, more rounded views of sexuality?
No, I'm not saying that it's a bad thing. I'm not saying it's a good thing either. I think that if you're addicted to cakes and there's 100 different cakes out there for you to choose from, which one do you go for? I think it doesn't matter on which one's more dangerous or which one's more harmful or which one's got better ingredients for you. It's about the education that comes behind it. This is the thing, that there is a lack of education of looking at sex as a sexual expression, rather than just teaching people about sex as procreation, and that's it. I think sex is a wonderful thing, and I think people should be enjoying it more. But this is the thing, it all comes down to choice. Providing it's consensual, it doesn't harm a third party. Nobody has the right to choose what people are doing behind closed doors. But we do have a right to supply education to be able to allow people to make those choices for themselves. And if they're dictated to by a dictatorial state that's what's allowed to be shown online and what's not, then that choice has been taken away from them. So how on earth can they learn what's right and wrong in their own opinion?
Well, I don't want our conversation necessarily to focus too much around the censorship issue per se, because in a sense, I think Matt sees that as an issue that does need to be addressed. But for you, Matt, I believe it's more about the ultimate sort of question of whether porn is harmful to society. Is it ultimately something that we need to be wary of and so on? Let me just, before we come back to you, Matt, and start to kickstart this discussion, say that if you're interested in responding to today's issue yourself, you're listening and you'd like to get in touch, unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the email address, I should say, to get in touch with the show. And we'll hear some of your feedback to recent shows towards the end of today's programme. You can also find us online via our social media, at UnbelievableJB on Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to follow on Facebook. Leave a comment that way as well. You can find today's show online and leave a comment there as well. All available with links to my guests from today's programme at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Matt, let's come back to you. We're talking about whether porn is harmful to society on Unbelievable today. Matt Frad is the author of a new book, The Porn Myth. It's a number one bestseller on Amazon. Critiques many modern myths, as he sees it, about why porn is supposedly harmless, you know, between consenting adults. And we've heard that already just there from Charlotte, Matt, that when it comes to two adults, consenting adults, what they do behind closed doors, it's up to them. Don't worry yourself about it. Let them make the choice. I mean, what do you say to that particular argument? It's just about people's free choice in terms of what they want to consume as consenting adults.
I sympathize with a lot of what Charlotte and Adam had to say there. We live in a global economy, right? Porn is consumed in every nation on the planet. The fact is that national laws, judicial systems, regulatory agencies move a lot slower than technology. I have no brilliant ideas about how to change that, nor am I that interested in doing it. I think a conversation can be had about whether or not governments choose to regulate pornography use. I think an argument can be made. But, you know, in my opinion, I can sympathize with Adam in saying that some versions of these of censoring pornography that I've heard of sound like prohibition laws in America back in the 1920s, which would unnecessarily turn, you know, relatively normal citizens into, you know, criminals. Okay, so I get that. But that said, before we even decide whether or not we should speak out against pornography, you know, maybe it's not a matter of censorship. Maybe it's about educating people that it leads to negative effects. Well, before we can have that conversation, we have to ask, well, is it harmful at all? And it turns out that it is. There are currently 33 neuroscience-based studies on porn users. Every one of them supports the addiction model, huh? And this has led to an increase in porn-induced erectile dysfunction. And again, I want to make it clear, this isn't something that Christians are talking about. These are people like Dr. Abraham Morgenthaler, who's the clinical urologist at Harvard Medical School, Norman Doidge, who wrote The Brain That Changes Itself. There are literally tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of stories of men online who say, I cannot get an erection when I'm with my girlfriend, when I'm with my wife, but when I'm with porn, I can. We should take that seriously. The other way it affects us is that it warps our sexual tastes. There was a study done in 2012 of NoFap users, which is a non-religious online forum, has about 200,000 members. And many of them said, it was over around 60%, said that their sexual tastes became increasingly extreme or deviant. And now you might be thinking, well, maybe they're just discovering who they really are and what their sexuality really is. Well, that's not true, because when they took time away from pornography, they found that their sexual tastes kind of went back to the way they were before. So that's that's how it's affecting us individually.
I wanted to kind of come back on this issue of the science, because I think this is a fascinating area. Do you want to give us a very brief summary of what's going on neurologically when people view pornography, and why that inhibits ultimately or kind of gives this, I think it's almost like a law of diminishing returns in terms of what they then find arousing, just in terms of normal sexual interactions?
Right. So, you know, doctors and scientists used to think that in order for something to be addictive, it had to be a substance that you put into your body, like nicotine, alcohol, and whatever. But since neuroscientists started looking into the brain, it's changed how we understand addiction, right? What we now know is that it's not necessarily just about what we put into our bodies or how it got there, but what reactions it triggers in the brain. And so the fact is, behaviors that are addictive or drugs that are addictive, in order for them to be addictive, what they must do is boost a neurotransmitter in the brain called dopamine in the reward center of the brain. And what we're discovering is when people consume pornography compulsively, that this leads to a downgrading. Huh? Dopamine begins to shrink. And then the nucleus accumbens, that's the name of the reward center, is now in a state of dopamine craving. Because of this, people find they need to use more pornography, and often more deviant or what they would consider harder forms of pornography, just to boost the dopamine levels up enough just to feel even. One more thing I want to say. In 2014, a study came out of the Max Planck Institute in Germany, that's sort of the Harvard of Germany in Berlin. Simone Kuhn, the lead neuroscientist researcher, and her team were able to show that there was a correlation between the amount of porn people used and shrinkage in the brain, right? So these people that they studied on weren't self-declared addicts. They said they used pornography moderately, and yet it was having this negative effect on the brain. So it leads to desensitization and this feeling within the person, okay, I need to be viewing much more just to feel even. It's as if we've reset the pleasure thermostat in our brain.
So, yeah, it's an interesting analogy. Okay, let me bring in my other guests. Adam, what do you want to say? I mean, the science appears to speak for itself that viewing pornography has this addictive effect, and that ultimately it means that people find it actually harder to have, if you like, normal sexual relations outside of a pornographic
kind of
images.
I did try and have a look at some of Matt's case studies in his book very briefly, I appreciate there will always be people that that find something addictive or obsessional in all ways. But I'm a great believer that people can be self-regulatory, and you know, in philosophy they say the wise man is the one who knows his own limitations, and I think we should all know our own limitations. And if what you're saying is true, Matt, then surely 90% of the population would have shrinking brains. I mean, dopamine, yes, dopamine does exist. I think some of the antipsychotic medication that psychiatry that suppresses the dopamine levels. Cannabis is known to be a dopamine antagonist. I won't get off the subject here. To say that you've got to have a blanket ban on pornography because of a few individuals that have problems, yet, and I don't want to deny those people the help that they deserve, they rightfully deserve. This is, I think, too much time in front of a computer looking at anything can be detrimental to one's health, for your eyesight, etc. But there will always be an exception to the norm, if you know what I mean.
And you don't see this as the norm then, as far as you're concerned?
Not at all. I mean, I know only a friend of mine, she knows that her children has, you know, unobtrusively looked at the pornography. But she said to me recently that at least I know what sexuality, how my children are sexually inclined. How far would Matt take it? I mean, children are given sexual education lessons at school, which involve sexual imagery and pictures of male and female genitalia. Are you saying that all children that are subject to sex education are also deranged in some way or have shrinking brains?
Matt, do you want to come back on that?
Oh, yeah, no, not at all. I actually think that you and I, Adam, are probably in more agreement than you think. I'm not talking about censorship. I'm not denying that people can do whatever they want. Of course people can do whatever they want. What I'm saying is that it's prudent before engaging in a behavior that might have detrimental effects, that one have the most information at their disposal. I know you would agree with that. I know Charlotte would as well. But certainly one can educate children about sex, the goodness of their bodies, right, and these sorts of things. I don't consider that pornographic. All I'm saying is, if there's good reason to think that pornography is detrimental to us and to our relationships, right? Studies have shown that even moderate use of vanilla porn leads people to think less of their partner's affection, physical appearance, sexual performance. All I'm saying is that people have a right to know that. So yeah, that's it.
Let me come to Charlotte before we have to go to a break. Charlotte, what's your take on all this? You have seen a lot of men yourself, and do you find that they are having difficulty being aroused outside of pornography if they're using it
a
lot?
You know, I have a complete mixture. I mean, what we've got to look at is a sense of, is society not understanding the differences between the reality side of sex and the fantasy side of sex? The fantasy side of sex has been drummed onto the internet, that's easily accessible, whereas the reality side of sex is not something that is so accessible because it doesn't get the numbers of viewers when it comes to pornography online. I think we've all got some valuable points to this conversation overall, but the biggest picture is whether anything is bad for you or detrimental to your health. Life is detrimental to your health. Everything causes different issues within our bodies, cancer, different ailments and such. It's about understanding that level of what is deemed as normal and what can be deemed as harmful. Again, going back to the point of, you know, it's cheaper for you to eat unhealthy than it is for you to maintain a healthy lifestyle, because it's what advertisers or creators are able to get monies from. What's that bigger value? And pornography is. There aren't many people out there that offer an understanding of reality fantasy than there is just fantasy that could be deemed as hardcore. This is a problem. When you look at what everybody's been saying about education, it's not education that we're understanding about the human bodies for identities, diversities and fantasies. We're learning about how to procreate, and that's it. There is no such thing as what goes into a sex education class of different tools, of toys that can be used within the bedroom. It's not. It's boy has penis, girl has vagina, and this is how you procreate. There is nothing on the lines of understand the different elements of sexual fantasy, sexual arousal that needs to be able to given for these people to be able to make a choice. And if the only element for them to be able to see something that's different outside of school is pornography, that's where they'll go.
So your view is not that we should in any way censor pornography. We should simply give young people more information about what the reality
more
is.
More information
of what's
and
out
give
there.
Them a choice to be able to make that decision for themselves. Because if that education is not out there, how do people learn whether what's good, what's
I mean,
not good,
should we, what, I think,
how much should they view?
Do you think then those who are producing pornography should, as it were, put health warnings on their material to say this may detrimentally impact your, you know, your sexual ability? Over,
it's
you know.
Not their responsibility to do that as a provider. It wouldn't. But you have to look at in what does pornography actually do? And they do this. They do put information onto their films. Good ethical pornographers will put information on there to say, number one, that everything that is within this content of this video has been consensually approved. No harm was caused to any of the producers or any of the performers. And I think that's ethical. And I like that. I like the fact that if I am watching pornography online, it is of hardcore nature, that I know that everything was consensual and nothing is deemed unnatural. And I'm happy with that. It's not about that. It's not about the pornographers, because at the end of the day, the pornographers are the people out there are the only ones that are fighting to ensure age verification processes are on those websites. The government's not doing that. The pornographers are doing that, which shows that they are caring towards the youth of the community.
But
we're not on about that. What we're on about is giving people an opportunity to be able to have that education and knowledge out there to make up their own mind.
Okay, let's take a break there, and we'll be back in a moment's time talking about pornography on the show today. Again, just a disclaimer, today's show obviously dealing with subjects of a sexual nature may not be appropriate for children. Please bear that in mind if you're listening with children within earshot. Asking, is porn harmful to society today? Matt Frad is author of a new book, The Porn Myth. He's in conversation today with Charlotte Rose, who we just heard from, and Adam Scarborough from the Campaign Against Censorship. We'll be back in a moment's time. Here I am to worship. Bless the Lord, oh my soul. These are the songs that have shaped the 21st century church. In the May edition of Premier Christianity magazine, we chart the history of the UK's modern worship movement and its global impact. Plus, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, writes for us on praying for God's kingdom to come. And with a snap general election on the cards, we ask just how involved should Christians be in politics. All that plus much more. Ask for your free sample copy of the latest magazine, premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back. Today's show on Unbelievable deals with subjects of a sexual nature may not be appropriate for children. Please do bear that in mind if you're listening with young people, children in earshot of your radio or your podcast device. And if you want to listen to the full programme at a later stage, available, of course, from the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Today, though, it's an ethical issue that we're tackling. Pornography, certainly something that many Christians campaign against in one way or another. But Matt Frad, my guest on the programme today, author of a new book, The Porn Myth, says even non-religious people can agree with him that porn is harmful for society. The proliferation of online pornography, its accessibility, has had damaging effects on the psychology of people, especially young men who are changing the way they think about sexuality altogether. And he says we need to be wary of this. We need to simply make sure that people are aware of the negative impact of porn, the porn myths that he describes through a lot of chapters in the book. It's actually deals with lots of things in short order, the book. And again, if you want to find out more, thepornmyth.com. Adam Scarborough from the Campaign Against Censorship and Charlotte Rose, who's a sexual freedom campaigner, also join me in studio and on the line to talk about this issue. Coming back to you, Matt, before we hear from Adam again and Charlotte. I mean, Charlotte saying there, as far as she's concerned, as long as it's done ethically, and she approves of the use of, she prefers if people are going to use it to have these ones that are in some way ethically sourced. It says that there was no harm done in the making of this, and so on. And what's your view on that? Because presumably, from your point of view, it's not just about consenting adults. Presumably, right. You believe the problem goes a bit deeper than that.
I do. I do think that one can make a non-religious argument against pornography. I clearly think that pornography is in and of itself immoral. I'd be happy to talk about that if you want. The reason I'm speaking about the effects of pornography is I think that people have a right to know about them, and it usually moves people a great deal. This idea of ethical pornography, to me, it's somewhat of an oxymoron. You know, in 2007, there was a study done in which 304 sex scenes of the most popular pornographic DVDs were reviewed, okay? And what they found in this study was an incredible amount of physical aggression and verbal aggression. There was actually an act of physical aggression, such as slapping, choking, hair pulling, verbal aggression, every minute and a half. Now, Charlotte wants to say, well, it's okay because they both consent to it. And I certainly agree that that's part of it. We don't want people being forced to do things they don't want to do, obviously. But the idea that someone can consent to being degraded like that, and that somehow makes it okay, I disagree. I think that being cool with being degraded doesn't make being degraded any more cool. I mean, suppose you met somebody who was okay being part of different, say, little racist videos where they were the butt of the joke. And they say, well, they found this liberating. People should be able to do what they want, you know, and don't take yourself so seriously. We might say to them, I get that you're saying you find this liberating, but I think that you're wrong too. I don't think you ought to be treated like that. Secondly, I want to respond to Charlotte's point. She seems to think that our only options are we look at hardcore porn or people just aren't getting taught about sex. And I think that's nonsense. I think parents have a duty to teach their children about the beauty of sex. Now, when my wife and I got married, we saved sex until our wedding night. And what a beautiful thing now that we have the rest of our lives to learn how to please each other and to enjoy this sexual embrace, which is such a good thing. We don't have to turn our eyes away from each other, okay, onto a screen to watch actors pretending to enjoy sex. Many of these actors, I think it would be fair to say, have suffered a degree of trauma in their childhood, might be having different diseases. No, I don't want to do that. I just want to look at my wife. I think she's enough for me. I think this is the sort of relationship people have a right to, that they want to have. And very often we become jaded and think, well, that kind of love isn't possible, so I'm just going to settle for pornography.
Let's bring Charlotte in, because obviously you were
addressing... Yes, please.
Yeah,
yes,
go ahead. I mean, a few different things to pick up there, Charlotte. Go ahead.
I think that was actually awful, what Matt just said. And for a start, porn stars are not diseased. Secondly, we're not all into a point of view about sex that we wait till our wedding night to have sex. The majority of children of today have already lost their virginity before they're in long-term relationships. So that's quite Arcadian. That's very, very ancient times. But I do appreciate other people's traditions. But to say that porn performers have all been abused, this is the unfortunate thing about the way that society sees sex workers as performers. They always see us very 2D, which is either very tragic or very glamorous. Very tragic in the sense that we've been abused. We've been abused, and that's the only reason why we can do this job. And I find that anybody that says that is absolutely degrading to any sex worker or performer out there. I know many performers out there who absolutely love being in films because that's their choice to do so. When it comes to being choking or being spanked or being slapped, there are many thousands of people out there that enjoy different kinks within their bedrooms of sex. Does not mean that somebody else may agree to it, but who are you to decide what is norm and what is not norm? There's no such thing. This is a great thing about being individual, for people's personal preference when it comes to the bedroom. The normative element to it is very, very sad. And to think that everybody has been abused that ends up in porn is awful. And I don't know how much more I can do with this conversation, because my throat is absolutely killing me. So I'm just going to stay on the back burn on this for a little bit. I'm going to let Adam.
Yeah.
Carry
okay.
On,
we'll right, let Adam? We'll let Adam take over a bit. I know you're joining us with some tonsillitis at the moment,
but let's take much time.
Go ahead, Matt.
Charlotte, I appreciate what you're saying, and I actually agree with what you're saying. I didn't say that all sex workers have been sexually abused or molested or abandoned as children. I agree with you. To make a blanket statement like that would be irresponsible at best, okay? So I don't want to take up too much time. I know Adam wants to respond, but I'd like to pick up on that thread afterwards, if that's okay.
Well, do you want to just respond before Adam comes back to
sure.
the fact that obviously Charlotte's saying there as well,
right,
that as far as she's concerned, you're entitled to your view that sex is best saved till marriage, Matt, but everyone else, you know, she described it as archaic, actually, because kids are having, you know, sexual encounters well before they're into it.
Notice that I didn't say my wife and I hadn't had sex until marriage. I mean, it's not like, you know, we were virgins. Like, I had slept around, I did stuff. But when I met her, I thought she was worth the wait. And that was my personal preference. I accept that that's not Charlotte's, and that's fine. And she also said that she respects others' traditions, and so I appreciate that. I don't feel attacked at all in that. I did mention about many performers suffering from some kind of disease, and that's actually a quote from Dr. Sharon Mitchell, who's the founder of the Adult Industry Medical Healthcare Foundation, right? She says that 66% of porn stars have herpes, and I'm not sure we need a lot of stats to convince us of that. If we're having sex with multiple people for our job, what are the chances we aren't going to be struggling with different sorts of diseases? And it didn't say all women. Now, what about women who might have suffered some serious form of abuse or neglect when they were younger? Certainly not all women, not making that argument, but many women do. Pamela Anderson just came out, spoke about being sexually abused. Jenna Jameson talks about being gang raped in high school. Bella Knox, the Duke University porn performer, speaks about being a rape victim, an ex-cutter. We can go on and on. All I'm saying is when I speak with women who've been in the sex industry, or when I listen to them after they get out, that very often they do talk about this sort of story. It's drearily predictable. Is it all women? No, but I think it is a lot. And I think we should recognize that that might be one of the factors that led them into porn. But I do think that even if somebody wasn't abused, they've had a lovely childhood and they just choose this. Look, this is my opinion. And I grant that Charlotte's going to disagree, maybe Adam as well. That's fine. But I think it's actually a manful thing to treat a woman who has forgotten her dignity with dignity nonetheless.
Let's come back to Adam, and then I'm sure Charlotte will want to weigh in again in the course of the programme. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I can say, I mean, my mum being a former bunny girl, my mum was one of the original bunny girls in the 60s, and she looks back on her modelling days and the Playboy Mansion, you know, with a great degree of pride. Still got some of the photographs. But I'm glad Matt does admit that sex does exist, you know, because it's a very, very powerful urge.
I mean, but having said that, Adam, I mean, the bunny girl thing, it was a kind of a different age, and if you don't, I'm in a sense somewhat more innocent, if you can grade these things.
Innocent, yeah. You know, she did other things as well, but it was, how can I start, the first start of the porn genre, if you like. I mean, and pornography, let me make it clear, porn, like the term prostitute, are two very, very emotive words. I prefer the term, I think, erotography, and for prostitute, I think it was the term sex worker. And to concur with Charlotte, I do have a great degree of sympathy for women, particularly streetwalkers. I think 140 have been killed over the last 10 years, and I find this very, very sad. They should be given respect. They shouldn't be treated in any punitive fashion. But to get back to what Matt was saying, and Charlotte, Maslow, the psychologist, has admitted in his triangle of needs that sex is at the top. It's there with food and water and shelter. It is a need. And as I say, most people are self-regulatory. You know, if they look at pornography two times a day, they'll probably put it down and pick up Shakespeare. They know when enough is enough. And getting back to the psychological effects of pornography, as Matt, you know, went overboard on this, especially in some of his case studies in his book. I've looked at some of the Kinsey studies, sexual studies, and it said that actually masturbation, when it comes to, I know this is a family show, so I apologise for using that word.
It's all right.
You know, when it comes to intensity of orgasm, masturbation cannot be excelled. Whether it leads to an exacerbation of dopamine levels or not, I've never heard that one before. But I think we should also look at some of the case studies that Matt has provided for us, and to find out what sort of background those people came from, whether it's a guilt-ridden background.
One of the things you're saying, or I'm picking up from you there, Adam, is the idea that you know, everyone has sex drives, and this is just one way in which it can be released for certain people. You talked about your comrades in the army, and obviously they were using pornography as part of that, you know, in an environment where they didn't have their partners around or whatever.
I think to say they used it, they would probably say they studied it. They just studied it. I've only studied it myself. I haven't actually used it.
But regardless, I mean, the point being that for you, that's a legitimate thing. That's just a way of dealing with the natural urges that you have.
Well, I'd compare it to what Desmond Morris said in his book, The Naked Ape. I think he referred to these things like smoking as a displacement activity. He went on to say something about anti-expirational behaviour as animals we really like. And I know Christians don't necessarily see us as animals, but we like to be on the savannas. But all this is really a form of anti-expirational behaviour. And yes, masturbation and pornography does enhance the experience.
Okay, Matt, what about the argument that it's just an outlet? It's just a way, you know, that people are naturally going to be looking for this stuff anyway. So go ahead.
Well, I mean, Adam said that sex is a need. He said like shelter, food and water, but that's clearly not true. If you don't have sex, you're not going to die. But if you don't have food, water, or shelter, you very well may. So I grant sexual desire is a beautiful thing, right? It should propel us to make a gift of ourselves. But what pornography does is it actually does, we don't end up making a gift of ourselves. We end up kind of reverting back into ourselves. I think one of the most sex positive things a person can do is quit pornography, because there's nothing sex positive about masturbating to images of women pretending to like you. There's nothing about retreating into the bathroom or to the bedroom to masturbate to porn. And a lot of people are beginning to recognize this. They're quitting porn not because they hate sex or because they think it's bad or dirty, but they're quitting porn precisely because they want to have a meaningful sex life, which pornography is robbing from them. We should point out, too, that when I talk about sexual dysfunction, and by the way, this study was a study that came out of Cambridge, right? So again, these are legitimate studies that are coming out of legitimate universities that showed around 60% of those said they could get an erection with porn, not without it. But also women who aren't able to have the same kind of climax because of the pornography they've been consuming. So again, I think if you want to be sex positive, quit porn. If you want to be sexually dissatisfied, then continue looking at porn, because apparently that's the way to do it.
Okay. I'll bring you in if your voice allows now, Charlotte, to respond to this. What do you want to say?
I think with Matt, studies that he's been getting the information from, I think it's fantastic that there is information out there, but it would be very interesting to find out how many participants were into those studies and also the ratio between men and women, because one of the things that we keep forgetting about is it's not just men that watch porn but females too. And I think that, considering if Cambridge has done a study on 200 people yet there's over a million people in the world watching pornography, I think there's plenty of room for more studies to come for in the future. I think this just comes straight back down to the simple element right at the beginning, is if people have only got one way to be able to view something that's in the privacy of their own home, which is pornography, which may be deemed as hardcore, that's the genre that we're talking about, obviously, then people are going to do whatever is seen in front of them. I think that if we're offering more education to children and there's more education available online to give those people that choices, that, like what Matt said, this is what's been happening with this percentage of people, then we should be made aware of it. I think that if you are feeling, I'm a sexual trainer, I do lots of work with men with erectile dysfunction and also premature ejaculation. And a lot of it is not deemed to pornography, it's actually done to psychology of where something has happened in their past that was detrimental to them growing up with their own self-confidence. So, my studies have actually dealing with hands-on people. Over 1,200 people I've dealt with in the past 7 years for erectile dysfunction and premature ejaculation. And out of that, I think I've only ever come across 9 people that have had any difference that's been caused from porn addiction, as it were, if it was that.
What about,
but we're not talking about that.
Well, I did want to bring up something else that Matt raised earlier and we didn't really get to, which is his contention that there's a sense in which exposure to pornography and the fact that, if you like, to recreate the kind of dopamine levels means that people end up searching more and more kind of gratuitous, hardcore stuff. And I'm guessing even more taboo stuff, Matt. I don't know if you want to talk to this and then I'll bring Charlotte back on. But are you saying that there's a link actually between consensual adult pornography and child pornography?
Well, I appreciate what Charlotte just brought up, having to say about how many people are being interviewed and these sorts of things. One study that happened I mentioned it earlier, from NOFAP, there were 1,500 people in the survey, right? Almost 60% said or agreed with the statement that their sexual desires had become increasingly deviant, and that when they stopped looking at porn, they were able to, they no longer desired that sort of thing. Charlotte also used the analogy of junk food a while back. I think that's a good analogy. I think if people become accustomed to junk food, they can't imagine how you could possibly eat healthy and be happy. They might say it's archaic, right? But if someone who is looking at pornography, they might say the same thing. How could you possibly live your life without masturbating to pornography? Well, I do live my life like that, and I'm actually really happy. And a lot of people view pornography like that. They see it as sexual junk food that's kind of ruining their sexual template, their sexual relationships, and quit it. And in the beginning, they might think, gosh, this is really hard. How could you do this? But eventually, they come to appreciate living a life where they don't spend hours on end every day looking at pornography.
Well, you do have a chapter in your book that talks about the link between pornography and child pornography. Do you think there
right,
is a kind
yeah,
of a sort of a slippery slope of some kind?
Well, I do think that. I mean, do we really think that there's someone out there, perhaps say 25 years old, right? They've never seen pornography, and one day they wake up and they think to themselves, you know what I'd like to look at today? You know, insert weird fetish here. I don't think that's how it happens. I think what happens is people begin to watch pornography, and then this old stuff doesn't do it for them anymore. What they have to do is view increasingly shocking pornography, because, of course, shock and anxiety actually boost dopamine, it boosts sexual arousal, and they end up looking at things that perhaps a year ago may have made them frightened or nauseous, but today it's the only thing that can get them off. So I do think that very often that it's a slippery slope, as you say.
Do you want to respond to that, Charlotte?
There's many, many, many of people in this world, and it's like reading the star sign. That I'm a Virgo, and if I read it week, it may be attentive to my needs, but then the next week it may not. I think that there's many different people with different perceptions of the way that they see things, and as long as we're providing informative information for them to be able to make their mind up, then, you know, we can't speak for everybody, but we can just support people as they go.
Charlotte seems very open to the evidence, which I want to commend her for, right? She's saying, okay, well, maybe we should look at these studies. People have a right to education. I think that's fantastic. So can I just ask a question to Charlotte? Charlotte, if what I am saying is true, if studies are showing that pornography can lead to addiction, sexual dysfunction, if it can lead to a breakdown in relationships, would you be open to going where the science points and saying, okay, you know, pornography can be detrimental and we should warn people about that or not?
I think, do you know what the thing is? Is it, unfortunately, I can't equip myself with answering that particular question, because I'm not educated enough in the studies that goes against what you say. And I know that there are, and if Jerry Barnett, for example, from Sex and Censorship was here, and maybe Adam could tell you differently, there are actually probably just as many studies that go against the studies that you've had. So the only thing I can do is look at it as a human element, a humanistic approach to it, that providing that we are open to the yes and to the no, then it's our choice to make that decision about the factor that happens in our lives. And that's the only way I can go.
Let me bring in Adam. Adam, are you aware of any studies that go against what Matt's talking about?
Well,
here?
I think there's probably a number. I'm not sure whether it was a Kinsey report, but I think there was a study which actually said, to contrast what Matt was saying, that actually masturbation does actually prepare you for sex, and your penis wouldn't actually be right for sex if you didn't masturbate. So as Charlotte rightfully says, there are studies out there that which will support that. But can I just say this, that what Matt's saying is a bit of, in a way, it's a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, because he's saying that pornography is wrong as a premise. This in itself will promote guilt to anyone who studies or sees pornography. So it's a little bit of a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. But the other thing here is, Matt mentions being married, yes, and I'm sure a union of two people is very beautiful, but relationships and marriage of that kind aren't for everyone. And Charlotte will agree with me here that many people that use sex workers and probably pornography are in fact disabled people who have no other avenue for their desires. I mean, are we saying that we should fill them with this guilt trip, that they shouldn't look at porn anymore? And I will agree with Matt, you know, if it stays at that level of just looking at, you know, purely isolationist looking at nothing else, then it maybe could be dangerous. But there are many other things that are also isolationist. Isolation in itself is not a nice thing. No man is an island. But I do feel, Matt, that you're moralizing on other people's behalf, really, without their consent, because for every negative out there, you probably will find a positive. And as I say, there is a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy in there as well.
Let me toss it back to Matt then. Matt, I mean, a couple of things there. Firstly, I think Adam references there may be some studies which show that, you know, masturbation and so on, not necessarily a bad thing. And also, he raises this issue of what are those who don't have recourse to a marriage like you have. This might be their only way of expressing their sexuality.
Right, thanks. Well, first of all, and I grant, right, this isn't an actual debate. So I'm certainly not expecting Charlotte or Adam to come prepared to this sort of conversation with studies in hand, okay? So I'm not expecting that. But I do want to say that I actually have looked at the research. I've just written a whole book about it. I have a whole chapter on masturbation, which actually argues against those who say that it's, you know, healthy, actually shows that it can correlate with things like anxiety and these sorts of things. So it's not enough just to throw out something that you've heard. You actually have to show the data behind it, or else – you know, maybe it's just something that we've heard, but it isn't actually true after all. Now, the idea that if people, porn's their only outlet, again, we're treating sex like it's a need, and certainly sexual desire is important and it's strong. But it's not like our only options are, I have to repress, or engage in internet pornography, right? To me, that's like saying our only options are, we have to be gluttons, you know, or we have to be anorexic. It's like, no, maybe there's a third option. Maybe we shouldn't be so binary about it. And I think there is a third option. I think it's what we would call sexual health. Regarding the self-fulfilling prophecy, Adam seems to be saying, Matt, you're coming at this from a moral perspective, and maybe that somehow, you know, shapes the way you look at this thing. Well, maybe it does, right? I mean, that might be somewhat of an ad hominem attack, though, to say because you're a Christian, you have this particular view about pornography, therefore your argument is invalid. But you'll notice that I've actually referenced 33 neurological studies. I've referenced a Cambridge study that came out in 2014. Another study, 2015, peer-reviewed research study, analyzed 22 different studies from 7 different countries and showed that there is little doubt that on average, those who consume porn are more likely to hold attitudes of sexual aggression and so forth. So again, fine, right? Like maybe I'm just obsessed about sex. Maybe I'm repressed. Maybe I'm moralistic. I don't think that for a second. But even if I was, that's not an argument against the sorts of studies that we're seeing coming out of academia.
We're going to go to a quick break, folks, and then we'll be just back for 5 or 10 minutes to conclude today's show. We'll hear again from Charlotte. That's one of our contributors, Charlotte Rose, a sexual freedom campaigner. Adam Scarborough is with me in studio from the Campaign Against Censorship. And Matt Fred's on the line, author of a new book, The Porn Myth. We're discussing, is porn harmful to society? Again, today's show, obviously dealing with subjects of a sexual nature, may not be appropriate for children. Please do bear that in mind in terms of who is listening nearby to today's broadcast. You can find today's show, of course, if you want to listen later, at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Come again in just a moment's time. We'll be continuing to discuss this important matter. Welcome back to the final part of Unbelievable this Saturday. We've been talking about pornography. And again, just before we go to our final segment of discussion today, a reminder that today's show does deal with subjects of a sexual nature and may not be appropriate for children. Please bear that in mind if you have children within earshot of your radio or podcast device. And in fact, today's programme for radio has been redacted and edited a little to make it suitable for broadcast this Saturday afternoon. If you want to listen back to the full unexpurgated edition of the programme, it's available online where you can download the show as a podcast. You can leave comments. You can look at all the other stuff besides. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable. Next week, I'm going to be telling you all about Unbelievable, the book. Yes, why after 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian. I'm going to be playing out the audio of a talk I've been giving at Unbelievable, the conference. And I'll be letting you know how to get your hands on a copy of the book as well. We're going to have a special website for that where you can find out more information about the book. And lots of people very interested to see me posting up some pictures of the very first copies that came into Premier's office this last week. Lots of good comments on the back of that. And I know lots of people eager to get their hands on a copy. We'll be dedicating the show to looking at the book this time next week. If you can stay on after Unbelievable today, I'm in conversation with Theo Hobson. He was with me on Unbelievable actually a month or two back, talking about his new book, God Created Humanism. Well, I sat down to talk to him about that for the profile interview. That's between 4 and 5 this afternoon. And still, of course, to come, some of your feedback to previous weeks of programming. Gary Habermas and Michael Collett were with me on last week's show. We've had quite a bit of response to that. And you'll be hearing from two friends of the show, Drew Sokol and Corey Markham. They've got an exciting new podcast project of their own called Hinge, and they're looking for your help in making it happen. I'll be introducing them to you a little later on at the end of today's show.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, concluding our discussion on pornography today on Unbelievable, we're asking, is porn harmful to society? Been a while since we did this subject, but we've had a fascinating discussion between my three guests today. Matt Fradd, author of a new book, The Porn Myth. says that many modern myths about the supposed harmlessness of porn are being disproved by science, sociology. You don't have to be a Christian, you don't have to be religious to see that pornography is harmful for society. Responding on this has been two guests, one in studio, Adam Scarborough from the Campaign Against Censorship, and Charlotte Rose, who's a sexual freedom campaigner, terms herself the First Lady of Sex. Today, we've been hearing all these different perspectives. Charlotte, before you have to leave us, do you want to sort of respond to anything that Matt had to say in that last part of the show?
Yeah, I just want to add to Matt's statement that, you know, he spoke about the two options. Well, there is actually a third option, and that should be education. And I think that education is the key to all of this at the end of the day. But I just wanted to, within that time, I've just managed to go onto my phone because I'm on the phone at the moment doing the interview with you guys. But I thought I'd have a quick look on there whilst I have it. I'm just one of the things that I wanted to bring up was about cancer with wine. And just a quick, this is what I Googled on the first page of Google, that the scienceblog.cancerresearchuk.org in the 29th of July 2015, that red wine can actually reduce the risk of cancer, whereas the Independent on the 8th of February 2017 said that wine can increase cancerous cells within the body. So all I've got to do is state that, you know, despite whether we find lots of information to say one thing, that we need to be able to look at things in a biased way to say that there's always an equal and opposite of everything that we say. So I appreciate Matt's hard work and efforts to go for the book, and I would love to read the book and find out the information that Matt had got. But there are just as many studies out there, whether it be UK-based or USA-based, stating the exact opposite. So providing you have given people, the readers, an option to be able to choose for themselves rather than being dictated to the views that you found, then I'll be more than happy to read it.
I'd be interested to hear what Matt has to say about your analogy with wine and cancer and so on. But you say education is the key, Charlotte. I mean, are you willing...
It is the key.
And do you think young people should be educated about the issues Matt's presenting, about these may cause you problems
if you get
addicted to pornography?
Yes, they should be presented both sides. This is the whole point about education. It's about learning the both sides to give people an opportunity to have a choice. I never said right at the beginning that Matt was not correct, but I never said he was correct either. People need to have the opportunity to be educated in both sides of the story to be able to make the decision for their own mind. That's what the whole point of life is, right? It's to choose. And to have that choice in their life is what we're allowed at the end of the day. So providing that information is there, then yes. But I don't feel as though it's good to be dictated to that this is the only way it should be. Because it's not about what we all believe. It's about people's choices in life.
Thank you very much for being on the line today, Charlotte. Really interesting to have you on.
Thank you for letting me crush you all.
Well, I appreciate you. Very kind of you to come on, even though your throat was not in great condition today. And I hope it hasn't worsened it too much being on the programme. But in any case, I'll make sure there's a link to where people can find out more about you from today's programme as well. Thanks for being with us today, Charlotte. We'll come back to you in a moment, Adam. Matt, just before we come back to Adam as well, Charlotte's effectively saying, you know, well, science is constantly showing us different things. You know, one minute studies show wine's good for you, the next minute shows it's not good for you, and it's more than likely the same for pornography as well. Did you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate everything Charlotte said, and it was great having her on the show, great listening to her opinion, and I'm really happy to hear that she's open to where the evidence is pointing. Certainly, scientific investigation by its nature, being inductive, is always open to change. That said, if the preponderance of evidence is all on one side of an issue, then I think that we should follow the science where it leads. All right. So there are no direct causal studies that would show, causation between smoking nicotine and cancer or nicotine and addiction. Okay. All we have is correlative studies, but the preponderance of evidence is on the side of the fact that cigarettes do lead to cancer and so forth. And so we should just accept that. Likewise, I'm saying that the preponderance of evidence lies on the side of saying porn is addictive. It leads to things like sexual dysfunction, increased desire to look at more disturbing forms of pornography, that it leads to relationship breakdown and so forth. And, you know, she says, let's look at the education. Well, I've done it. That's the whole reason I wrote the book. And so I'm happy to hear, too, that she's open to reading the book and perhaps, you know, educating herself. And I think when she does that, she'll realize, you know, there's actually a lot of studies right now, as I say, 33 neuroscience-based studies that show porn can be addictive, and there's none on the other side. Now, actually, people might point to a 2013 or 2015 study by Nicole Prowse, okay? That's the only study anybody cites if they want to say pornography doesn't lead to addiction, doesn't cause addiction. But the problem with her studies is that there's actually been now 9 different peer-reviewed papers written by some of the world's top neuroscientists, all of which are showing that Nicole Prowse misinterpreted her data. And so even her papers show that pornography leads to desensitization, hypofrontality, and sensitization. So I'm all for it. Let's educate people.
Okay. Adam, anything you want to say as we start to close out today's show?
Interesting. It's nothing to do with today's subject, but interesting what Charlotte was saying about wine there. Wine also acts as a vasodilator, decreasing people's cholesterol. But on the subject of what Matt's saying, interesting what Matt was saying about the other side. I mean, it's quite obvious why the other side, as Matt says, in studies, because it's a case of leave well alone. Most people who use pornography as a release, as a safety valve, don't have a problem with it. This is why there is nothing on the other side. And again, there are so many variables here in these studies. I mean, if we were to look at some of those studies in Matt's book, you know, we're taking into consideration their upbringings of these people, why they had this disposition. And again, there's nothing said, and what I've seen about Matt's book, I must read it in greater detail, about what would have happened to these people had they not had access to porn as a result. And, you know, if you go back to 19th century psychiatry, there was actually a diagnosis then called masturbation psychosis, where patients were told to wave their arms around in the air 20 times a day in order to stop masturbating. 90% of men have masturbated, the other 10% are liars.
Okay. I mean, okay. I guess the point is, Matt, pornography is older, is as old as art. You know, you can find it on the walls of, you know, Roman villas and so on. It's hardly a new thing, and the things that go with it are hardly new either. So is that an argument to say, you know, you're kind of fighting a losing battle here?
No, I mean, there's lots of practices or actions that might be immoral that go back, you know, well into the past. That doesn't mean that they're good. And so I think that's also true of pornography. So, it's been lovely talking to Adam. I really want to encourage people to get the book. I want to let people know, too, that 100% of the royalties from this book go to help a group in San Diego that support sexually trafficked women. So I'm not making a cent from this book. And so I hope people will pick it up and decide for themselves.
Okay. And I'm sure a copy could be sent to Charlotte as well, who's interested in reading
it. I'd love to. Yeah, I'd love to.
Great, great stuff. Thank you very much for being on the program today, Matt, to talk about your book. Again, thepornmyth.com if you want to find out more. If people want to find out more about the campaign against censorship, I believe the website is dlas.org.uk.
Yeah, that's basically, or if they just Google campaign against censorship, it will come up. There's quite a lot of archived material in there, etc., which is interesting read. I do the occasional article myself, and it's been great speaking to Matt here today, and been very, very, very interesting.
Well, thank you, Adam, and to Charlotte as well, who's been on the line today on the programme. And if you want to get in touch with today's show, well, I'll give you the ways to do that in just a moment's time. Again, be interested to hear what you have to say about this, and wherever you're coming from on the issue, as ever, love to hear from you. Again, today's links to my various guests from today's program can be found at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, I look forward to hearing what you had to say about today's show. You can email me your responses, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And you can tweet and Facebook the show as well, @unbelievablejb. To follow on Twitter, facebook.com/unbelievablejb. If you want to get in touch via the Facebook page, you can leave a comment underneath today's show. And of course, find links to my guests, the podcast and much more besides at the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Here's a few of the bits and pieces that came in the last week in response to last week's show. Gary Habermas, US Bible scholar and Christian philosopher, joined me to talk to atheist Michael Collett about sincere disbelief. What do you do when atheists say, I've sincerely looked into this. I don't think I've got a prejudice against Christianity or connecting with God. I just haven't been convinced. Lots of praise for the show on Twitter. Tarshuk, who goes by the Owookie, said, a good episode from Unbelievable, looking at some of the intricacies of doubt and faith. Humans are complicated. Manuel said, when atheists sincerely disbelieve. Michael Collett and Gary Habermas, I enjoyed every bit. Matt Klinendinst says, excellent show, Justin. Dr. Habermas put on a masterclass on how to share one's personal testimony coupled with sound reasons for the faith. And Paul Grono said, another belter of a show, a mixture of wit, charm and honesty. Sincere discussion on sincerity. Wonderful. So lots of praise for the show on Twitter, but somewhat of a different story a little bit on the email. Some people said didn't feel that Gary did the job he should have done there. This was James, who said, listening to Gary Habermas dress up the no true atheist fallacy with some tangential psychological study was positively maddening. He shows the myopic nature of some Christians who are so convinced of their faith, they can't imagine a reasonable or logical argument against it. His line of thinking leaves atheists to be emotional brats who are angry at God, as opposed to folks who simply don't find Christianity compelling. I assume there are concepts Gary doesn't accept without the need for emotional rebellion. Why is he capable of such reasonable doubt, whereas atheists are not? I don't know, James, I didn't get the impression that Gary was saying all atheists are emotional brats angry at God. Maybe that's what you drew from it. I didn't get the sense that he was playing to that kind of feeling. But thank you very much for getting in touch. But Christians as well who had concerns for that. Kyle says, haven't written to you before. I'm from Australia. Found your program on iTunes a short time after I became a Christian 2 years ago. Generally always find your show to be greatly edifying. A case in point being the recent White versus Williams debate, which was brilliant. I never miss an episode. Part of the quality of the program is that you allow the best non-Christian arguments to be presented fairly, which only serves to strengthen the apologetic responses. However, sadly, I'm not sure you always allow the best Christian positions to be presented. I just listened to Habermas versus Collett and it was terrible. In over an hour, Dr. Habermas didn't make a single case for Christ to Mr. Collett. Collett even noted several times that he had not been looking forward to trying to defend his positions on the resurrection against a noted scholar like Dr. Habermas. Yet Dr. Habermas gave him a free pass with the excuse, well, I'm not going to change your mind in an hour. Or even more bizarrely, the bride isn't ready to be married yet. Has he forgotten that you have thousands of people listening, eagerly wanting to hear a response for the hope that is within us? I've listened to past Habermas shows and it's sadly the same thing time after time. Well, Kyle, respectfully, I've got to disagree with you there. I think when Gary Habermas has been on before, it's almost, you know, very frequently at least, been in the context of debating the resurrection, as he did with James Crossley a couple of years ago. And debating things like miracles as well with Michael Roos last year. And I think he was doing what he needed to do in that context, which is to defend those propositions from his viewpoint. And so in that case, I do think he has made the case for Christianity. Obviously, in this instance, he decided, you know, it was generally agreed that we weren't going to do a full debate on the resurrection. We were going to more talk about the issue at stake of sincere disbelief. But obviously, and not every show will involve a kind of complete defense of Christianity in that sense. So I appreciate your email, but respectfully do disagree with your conclusion to that. Thanks also to Mark from Blackburn, who says, great to hear Gary and Mike on the show today. Just been reading Nabil Qureshi's book, where Gary features a bunch of times. Looking forward to getting into some of his books. With regard to Michael Collett's article, it's true that the Bible says that people deny God because they're biased and in love with their own sin. In fact, it's not uncommon for people in the Bible to be disciplined for their lack of belief. One man cries out, Lord, forgive my unbelief, to Jesus, who doesn't disagree with him, suggesting that unbelief is itself sinful. Out of all the Christian virtues, faith is the one in Christian soteriology whereby you receive forgiveness and acceptance. It's precious within Christian doctrine, and the Bible is not neutral about its acquisition, where it's seen as a gift from God. Christianity unapologetically veers away from secular understandings of the mechanism of the acquisition of knowledge and instead describes faith and belief in spiritual terms. Michael feels like references to the psycho-spiritual elements of belief are ad hominem attacks, but it's much worse than that. They're a claim that not only is he psycho-spiritually biased in his decisions, but he is by nature incapable of believing in God without a divine gift of faith. Whilst this would superficially seem to undermine the entire project of apologetics and using reason to explain the gospel to others, the example of Jesus and the disciples make it clear that we should accept this duality of engaging evidence and reason whilst being fully aware of the spiritual reality as well. As St. Ignatius has said, to pray as if everything depended on God, but work as if everything depended on us. Thank you, Mark, for your comments and for all those who have been in touch in regard to last week's programme. Well, I'm joined on the programme now by two friends of the show, Drew Sokol and Corey Markham. Corey's actually been on the programme a couple of times as an atheist contributor. Drew has been a long-time listener of the programme. And, well, they kind of met through Unbelievable. They can tell us how that happened. And we're going to be hearing about a project that they've come up with together called Hinge. It's hoping to see the full fruition of it later in the year. But right now, they're working on getting this project funded. I'm a real enthusiast about this project. That's why I wanted to have these guys on in the last section of Unbelievable today to tell us about it, remind us about it, and tell us how we can help if we're able to when it comes to the funding of this project. Drew and Corey, welcome along to the program.
Hey, great to talk
to
you.
It's great to have you on via the wonders of technology from where you are in the USA. You're obviously together at this point. You guys, though, kind of got to know each other as both as listeners of Unbelievable. Do you want to just give us the quick story behind that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was a pastor in Los Angeles a couple of years ago, and there was this one Sunday when I was preaching at our three services about truth, and I was digging into questions, you know, classic questions like what is truth and how do we find something that we know will always be true. And this was kind of a pivotal day in my life, because as I was beginning to make that turn in a sermon towards Jesus and to talk about Jesus as being the ultimate source of truth, I looked out on the crowd that day and felt just this overwhelming feeling of doubt and a feeling of maybe feeling fake in that moment and wondering if the words that I was saying, did I even believe them at that moment? And that started about a 6 to 8 month process of reevaluating everything that I was doing in the pastorate as a believer, as a follower of Jesus. And in that time, I was kind of someone recommended that I start listening to this podcast out of London called Unbelievable with this guy named Justin Briley. And one of the first episodes I listened to, actually, Corey was a guest on there. And, you know, in a climate when it's so hard to find people who not only are well-informed and intelligent, but also humble at the end of the day and kind of see the strengths and weaknesses of arguments on both sides, there's something about the way that he was presenting his side, where he was at the same time confident and yet humble, that just appealed to me. And I had kind of had the stirring of an idea of wanting to create a story form podcast that not only appealed to the skeptics or the seekers, but also appealed to the apathetic, and got in touch with him about just kind of the seed of the idea. And once we got in touch, it just kind of took off. It's been a true, unbelievable friendship story, I guess.
Corey, do you want to tell us a little bit about Hinge, what it is exactly, and what people who tune into what you've done so far on the podcast would expect to hear, and what you're hoping to do in the fullness of time?
Yes. So Hinge is as you said, we refer to it as a narrative form podcast. Another way of describing it is a story-driven podcast. And that's to say that rather than just being one of the more typical discussion-based podcasts, of which there are many, we wanted to do something different. We wanted to find a way to appeal to the people who wouldn't necessarily be interested or maybe not inclined to look into these matters, history and theology and science. And so to kind of pick up where Drew left off, he heard me on Unbelievable. He reached out to me. Initially, it was just he was telling me about this idea of his, and he was interested in getting some other people involved. And then before I knew it, he just asked me if I wanted to be the co-host of the show. And I was like, hell yeah, to be honest. And yeah, and so I flew out to LA, we recorded a demo, and we sat on that demo for some time as we were promoting and trying to build support. And that brings us to where we're at this point. And right now we're actually at the last leg of a Kickstarter campaign in which we're trying to raise $20,000, which will help us. It will enable us to hire an audio producer to really make sure that the podcast that we produce is the best quality possible. But also it will allow Drew and myself to spend all of our time working on the show, interviewing people across the country, overseas, and anything and everything that goes along with making this sort of program. It's Hinge is, as I said, it's a story-driven podcast about an atheist and a pastor coming to grips with this incredibly influential historical figure, Jesus Christ, and everything that goes along with that. Belief, doubt, faith, everything you can imagine.
And I guess that's where the name comes from, Hinge.
Indeed.
Many people think of Jesus in some way as the hinge of history. You know, his life is the way we segment history in the past, AD and BC and so on. But I really, really enjoyed the pilot episode you did as a podcast. And I do encourage people to check that out. And I really like the idea of doing it kind of as a joint kind of investigation between you both and bringing in that personal element. It kind of reminded me in some ways of, you know, some of those types of podcasts, This American Life, Serial, those kinds of things, where you've got that kind of personal element, that journalistic element to it as well. So I personally can highly recommend this project to Unbelievable listeners. If you enjoy Unbelievable, I really think you're going to enjoy Hinge. So this is me saying, if you think you've got a few spare pounds or dollars to spare, can I encourage you to think about joining in this Kickstarter campaign, which doesn't have long to run. It's only 4 or 5 more days, guys, isn't it? And you've got quite a mountain to climb, it's fair to say. Just give us the stats of where you are and where you need to be.
Yeah, so the goal that we're trying to raise is $20,000. We're at about 30%, and we've got about 6 days left, give or take. So we do have a mountain to climb, but we do have a lot of generous support that has been garnered as it is. And we know that we have some people that are in the background waiting for us to get a little bit more momentum before they step in. And we're really confident about what we're doing, about our ability to do it, but we do need some help. Anything that you could do to support our cause, even if it just comes to sharing it for us, sharing it with friends and family, starting up a conversation about our podcast, but also just about this need that we over here in America are especially feeling, this need to engage in conversation with people that we disagree with about important issues.
So if people want to find out more, contribute, where should they go?
So you can, first of all, you can Google Kickstarter and Hinge, or you can specifically go to the Kickstarter website on which you can search for Hinge. Or you could even put in your search, you can put in atheist and a pastor, and that'll bring you right there. We also have our website at hingepodcast.org, and you can find links there to it as well.
I'll make sure there are links to the Kickstarter page from today's show as well. If you want to go there, it's as usual, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. But Drew and Corey, I wish you all the best for it. I'm really hoping that this will all come together, and I'm really looking forward to what the future holds for you both as you produce this narrative podcast together. But thanks for being on the show with me today.
Thank you,
that was
Justin.
Great. Thanks so much, Justin. You're unbelievable.
Well, the good news is that since I recorded that interview with Drew and Corey, their funding is now actually at about halfway mark. If you can help them reach the full goal, go to the Kickstarter campaign. Coming up next week on the program, I'm going to be talking about my new book. The first copies landed this past week, all very exciting, and we'll be broadcasting the talk that I'm giving at this year's Unbelievable the Conference. Why? After 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian. I'll be letting you know how you can get hold of the book wherever you live in the world. Do come back again for the show that aims to get you thinking every week, Unbelievable. Coming up next, I'm talking to Theo Hobson on The Profile. That's all for Unbelievable this week. See you next time.